Chapter 19. Understand why, I think you will, though perhaps you may not forgive me. But, dear Michael, I have done it for the best. I shall be in my grave when you read this, and Elizabeth Jane will have a home. Don't curse me, Mike, think of how I was situated. I can hardly write it, but here it is. Elizabeth Jane is not your Elizabeth Jane, the child who was in my arms when you sold me. No, she died 3 months after that, and this living one is my other husband's. I christened her by the same name we had given to the first, and she filled up the ache I felt at the other's loss. Michael, I am dying, and I might have held my tongue, but I could not. Tell her husband of this or not, as you may judge. And forgive, if you can, a woman you once deeply wronged, as she forgives you. Susan entered. Her husband regarded the paper, as if it were a window pane through which he saw 4 miles. His lips twitched, and he seemed to compress his frame, as if to bear better. His usual habit was not to consider whether destiny were hard upon him, or not the shape of his ideals in cases of affliction being simply a moody to suffer, I perceive. His much scorning, then, it is for me. But now through his passionate head there stormed this thought, that the blasting disclosure was what he had deserved. His wife's extreme reluctance to have the girl's name altered from Newson to Henchard was now accounted for fully. It furnished another illustration of that honesty and dishonesty which had characterized her in other things. He remained unnerved and purposeless for near a couple of hours, till he suddenly said, "Ah, I wonder if it is true." He jumped up in an impulse, kicked off his slippers, and went with a candle to the door of Elizabeth Jane's room, where he put his ear to the keyhole and listened. She was breathing profoundly. Henchard softly turned the handle, entered, and shading the light, approached the bedside. Gradually bringing the light from behind a screening curtain, he held it in such a manner that it fell slantwise on her face without shining on her eyes. He steadfastly regarded her features. They were fair. His were dark. But this was an unimportant preliminary. In sleep there come to the surface buried genealogical facts, ancestral curves, dead men's traits, which the mobility of daytime animation screens and overwhelms. In the present statuesque repose of the young girl's countenance, Richard Newson's was unmistakably reflected. He could not endure the sight of her, and hastened away. Misery taught him nothing more than defiant endurance of it. His wife was dead, and the first impulse for revenge died with the thought that she was beyond him. He looked out at the night, as at a fiend. Henchard, like all his kind, was superstitious, and he could not help thinking that the concatenation of events this evening had produced was the scheme of some sinister intelligence bent on punishing him. Yet they had developed naturally. If he had not revealed his past history to Elizabeth, he would not have searched the drawer for papers, and so on. The mockery was that he should have no sooner taught a girl to claim the shelter of his paternity than he discovered her to have no kinship with him. This ironical sequence of things angered him like an impish trick from a fellow creature. Like Prester John's, his table had been spread, and infernal harpies had snatched up the food. He went out of the house, and moved sullenly onward down the pavement till he came to the bridge at the bottom of the high street. Here he turned in upon a bypath on the river bank, skirting the northeastern limits of the town. These precincts embodied the mournful phases of Casterbridge life, as the South Avenues embodied its cheerful moods. The whole way long here was sunless, even in summer time. In spring, white frosts lingered here, when other places were steaming with warmth, while in winter it was the seed field of all the aches, rheumatisms, and torturing cramps of the year. The Casterbridge doctors must have pined away for want of sufficient nourishment, but for the configuration of the landscape on the northeastern side. The river slow, noiseless, and dark, the Schwarzwasser of Casterbridge ran beneath a low cliff, the two together forming a defense which had rendered walls and artificial earthworks on this side unnecessary. Here were ruins of a Franciscan priory, and a mill attached to the same, the water of which roared down a back hatch like the voice of desolation. Above the cliff, and behind the river, rose a pile of buildings, and in the front of the pile a square mass cut into the sky. It was like a pedestal lacking its statue. This missing feature, without which the design remained incomplete, was, in truth, the corpse of a man, for the square mass formed the base of the gallows, the extensive buildings at the back, being the county gaol. In the meadow where Henchard now walked, the mob were wont to gather whenever an execution took place, and there to the tune of the roaring weir they stood and watched the spectacle. The exaggeration which darkness imparted to the glooms of this region impressed Henchard more than he had expected. The lugubrious harmony of the spot with his domestic situation was too perfect for him, impatient of effects, scenes, and adumbrations. It reduced his heart burning to melancholy, and he exclaimed, "Why the deuce did I come here?" He went on past the cottage in which the old local hangman had lived and died, in times before that calling was monopolized over all England by a single gentleman, and climbed up by a steep back lane into the town. For the sufferings of that night, engendered by his bitter disappointment, he might well have been pitied. He was like one who had half fainted, and could neither recover nor complete the swoon. In words he could blame his wife, but not in his heart, and had he obeyed the wise directions outsider letter this pain would have been spared him for long, possibly forever. Elizabeth Jane seeming to show no ambition to quit her safe and secluded maiden courses for the speculative path of matrimony. The morning came after this night of unrest, and with it the necessity for a plan. He was far too self-willed to recede from a position, especially as it would involve humiliation. His daughter he had asserted her to be, and his daughter she should always think herself, no matter what hypocrisy it involved. But he was ill prepared for the first step in this new situation. The moment he came into the breakfast room, Elizabeth advanced with open confidence to him, and took him by the arm. "I have thought and thought all night of it," she said frankly. "And I see that everything must be as you say. And I am going to look upon you as the father that you are, and not to call you Mr. Henchard anymore. It is so plain to me now. Indeed, father, it is. For, of course, you would not have done half the things you have done for me, and let me have my own way so entirely, and bought me presents, if I had only been your stepdaughter. He Mr. Newson whom my poor mother married by such a strange mistake," Henchard was glad that he had disguised matters here, "was very kind, oh so kind." She spoke with tears in her eyes, "but that is not the same thing as being one's real father after all. Now, father, breakfast is ready," she said cheerfully. Henchard bent and kissed her cheek. The moment and the act he had prefigured for weeks with a thrill of pleasure, yet it was no less than a miserable insipidity to him now that it had come. His reinstation of her mother had been chiefly for the girl's sake, and the fruition of the whole scheme was such dust and ashes as this. 20. Of all the enigmas which ever confronted a girl, there can have been seldom one like that which followed Henchard's announcement of himself to Elizabeth as her father. He had done it in an ardor and an agitation which had half carried the point of affection with her. Yet, behold, from the next morning onwards his manner was constrained as he had never seen it before. The coldness soon broke out into open chiding. One grievous failing of Elizabeth's was her occasional pretty and picturesque use of dialect words, those terrible marks of the beast to the truly genteel. It was dinner time, they never met except at meals, and she happened to say when he was rising from table, wishing to show him something, "If you'll bide where you be a minute, father, I'll get it." "Bide where you be," he echoed sharply, "comma, good God, are you only fit to carry wash to a pig trough, that he use such words as those?" She reddened with shame and sadness. "I meant stay where you are, apostrophe father," she said, in a low, humble voice. "Ought to have been more careful." He made no reply, and went out of the room. the sharp reprim, and was not lost upon her, and in time it came to pass that for a she said, exceed, that she no longer spoke of humblers, but of humble bees, no longer said of young men and women, that they ought together, but that they were engaged, that she grew to talk of regals as ill hyacinths, that when as he had not slept she did not quaintly tell the servants next morning, that as he had been agrid, but that as he had suffered from indigestion. These improvements, however, are somewhat in advance of the story. Henchard, being uncultivated himself, was the bitterest critic the fair girl could possibly have had of her own lapses really slight now, for she read omnivorously. A gratuitous ordeal was in store for her in the matter of her handwriting. She was passing the dining room door one evening, and had occasion to go in for something. It was not till as he had opened the door, that she knew the mayor was there in the company of a man with whom he transacted business. Here, Elizabeth Jane, he said, looking round at her, just write down what I tell you a few words of an agreement for me, and this gentleman to sign. I am a poor tool with a pen. Be jowned, and so be I, said the gentleman. She brought forward blotting book, paper, and ink, and sat down. Now then an agreement entered into the 16th day of October right that first. She started the pen in an elephantine march across the sheet. It was a splendid round, bold hand of her own conception, a style that would have stamped a woman as Minerva's own in more recent days. But other ideas reigned then. Henchard's creed was that proper young girls wrote ladies, and nay, he believed that bristling characters were as innate and inseparable a part of refined womanhood as sex itself. Hence when, instead of scribbling, like the Princess Ida, and such a hand as when a field of corn bows all its ears before the roaring east, Elizabeth Jane produced a line of chain shot and sandbags, he reddened in angry shame for her, and, peremptorily saying, never mind I'll finish it, dismissed her there and then. Her considerate disposition became a pitfall to her now. She was, it must be admitted, sometimes provokingly and unnecessarily willing to saddle herself with manual labors. She would go to the kitchen instead of ringing, not to make Phoebe come up twice. She went down on her knees, shovel in hand, when the cat overturned the coal scuttle. Moreover, she would persistently thank the parlor maid for everything, till one day, as soon as the girl was gone from the room, Henchard broke out with, good God, why dost leave off thanking that girl as if she were a goddess born? Don't I pay her £12 a year to do things for ye? Elizabeth shrank so visibly at the exclamation that he became sorry a few minutes after, and said that he did not mean to be rough. These domestic exhibitions were the small protruding needle rocks which suggested, rather than revealed what was underneath. But his passion had less terror for her than his coldness. The increasing frequency of the latter mood told her the sad news, that he disliked her with a growing dislike. The more interesting, that her appearance and manners became under the softening influences which she could now command, and in her wisdom did command, the more she seemed to estrange him. Sometimes she caught him looking at her with a lowering invidiousness, that she could hardly bear. Not knowing his secret, it was cruel mockery that she should for the first time excite his animosity, when as he had taken his surname. But the most terrible ordeal was to come. Elizabeth had latterly been accustomed of an afternoon to present a cup of cider or ale and bread and cheese to Nance Mockridge, who worked in the yard wimbling hay bonds. Nance accepted this offering thankfully at first, afterwards as a matter of course. On a day when Henchard was on the premises he saw his stepdaughter enter the hay barn on this errand, and, as there was no clear spot on which to deposit the provisions, she at once set to work arranging two trusses of hay as a table, Mockridge meanwhile standing with her hands on her hips, easefully looking at the preparations on her behalf. Elizabeth, come here, said Henchard, and she obeyed. Why do you lower yourself so confoundedly? He said with suppressed passion. Haven't I told you what 50 times? Hey? making yourself a drudge for a common workwoman of such a character as hers. Why, ye'll disgrace me to the dust. Now these words were uttered loud enough to reach Nance inside the barn door, who fired up immediately at the slur upon her personal character. Coming to the door, she cried regardless of consequences, "Come to that, Mr. Henchard, I..." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.